Bread and Rosaries podcast is sponsored by Cold Vomit and Cold Wee.
Everyone's favourite UK-based leftist Christian podcast. I'm Ben Molyneux-Hetherington, I'm joined by Adam Spears and Luca von Badass, and all three of those are totally real names. Hello Adam, how you doing?
Yeah, I'm alright, how you doing?
Yeah, not too bad. And hello Lou, how are you?
Hello, I'm good, thank you.
Excellent. As you've probably noticed, we've been away on a little break, and in that time we have officially promoted Lou from guest to official host, a little round of applause or whatever. Maybe we'll put like a sample of like a thunderous applause there. So we're now a team of three, and therefore as Christians, we must pattern ourselves after God and decide which of us is which member of the Trinity. I've got a proposal. Adam, I think, is Jesus. He bangs on about poor people. He upsets a lot of people, and I'm pretty sure I've seen him wear sandals.
with socks.
Lou is the Holy Spirit, a mysterious later edition that will take things to the next level, and I'm God the Father. I've been around for a while, but it's not clear at this point exactly what I do that the other two don't deal with, and everyone politely ignores my history of saying and doing some deeply problematic stuff back in the day.
Wow.
Does that sound about right? Are we happy with that?
I mean, I do note, at risk of sounding like a heretic, some might say that you are giving yourself the most important role there.
I think that is heresy.
I'm not saying I'm saying that. I'm saying some might say.
When I was at Bible college, we'll put some booing in there to counteract the applause.
Smithies, are they booing?
No, they're saying boo-erns, boo-erns.
Are you saying boo or boo-erns?
I was saying boo-erns.
There was courses. There was one that was, one module was person and work of the Holy Spirit, and one module was person and work of Christ. And I always thought to myself how interesting it was that there wasn't a person and work of God the Father, who kind of seemed to do 6 days of creation and then let the other two take things over from there.
So are you now trying to redress the balance? God as podcast host.
Oh God, that is the worst metaphor for God I think I've ever heard. Yeah. Somehow you've been a heretic and I've said something even more offensive.
I have not been a heretic. I have not been a heretic. I have merely floated an idea.
Floating heresy is not doing heresy.
Exactly.
Floaters don't count. So, we've got Lou joining us, and that's one of the changes that we are bringing about to the podcast. We'll introduce a few more of the changes, but one of them is that the podcast as a whole is very much over being single and wants to settle down with another good Christian podcast to become one of those slightly disconcerting church couples that are just a little bit too keen on doing all the church stuff. So I have signed the podcast up to Christian Connection, and I've got some of the questions they make you answer before introducing you to to another lonely Christian, so you can both lie together to all your church friends about how you're definitely not having sex.
Or you're just doing it up the bum.
Yeah, which, as we all know, does not count. We have discussed this multiple times previously.
Loophole.
We are, of course, as good leftists, this podcast operates as a cooperative, so there is no one person in charge, but we all are equally...
Except Ben, the father.
The podcast.
Except Ben, who is God.
I mean, that is definitely heresy. You've definitely just implied that Jesus isn't God.
Implying something is not stating it, right? So I think you get
exactly,
away with that.
Exactly, it's floating heresy again, not doing heresy.
Pair of bloody theological lawyers here. It sounds like, and I'm just spitballing here, that maybe the pair of you have had a lot of experience having to justify why you're not heretics, maybe to keep your jobs in course or whatever.
I mean, to be honest,
how could you guess?
In the Church of England, they don't really care about that.
Yeah, so I signed us up to Christian Connection, and yeah, so we need to make a decision as a three about the answers to the questions for the podcast as a whole. So it might involve us working out what our individual answers are and then amalgamating them so we have a sense of what the podcast answers are. So some of them are quite funny, I think, and some of them are, just normal stuff. It starts with, what is your faith tradition? And it's got a long list of stuff. So it's got just Christian, Anglican / Church of England / Episcopal, Emerging Church, Free Church, Baptist, Evangelical, a whole list of them. And then right, almost at the very bottom, is Catholic, which I really enjoy, as though that's like a tiny little sect that no, you know, or one of those weird Catholics that they have occasionally, rather than, you know, one of the oldest expressions of it.
Well, literally the single biggest expression of it as well.
Yes. I really don't want to put Anglican.
We know you don't.
You are definitely Anglicans.
You're an Anglican too. Come on.
An Anglican in denial. It's an important distinction.
Which is an Anglican, right? Like we're all in denial,
yeah.
Ben.
If somebody is sure of their Anglican identity,
they are not an Anglican. Get them out.
What's the old joke about Methodists, isn't it? That a Methodist is an Anglican who doesn't think they're an Anglican, whereas an Anglican is an Anglican who doesn't think they're an Anglican, right?
Yeah.
I kind of think we're going to have to go Anglican because the other option is just Christian, and that brings me out in hives for some reason.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But that upsets me a little bit because... as a podcast, I think we are made of three Anglicans, but on some level, we're not an Anglican podcast, or at least we strive not to be, even though we do seem to keep coming back to it.
Maybe another option on that list should be barely Christian. I feel like that would describe you and most Anglicans very well, then.
Okay, so I can't believe this. I've left evangelicalism behind, right? And I come to hang out with my leftist Christian pals. And what do I get? Shaming for not attending church. This is unbelievable. I did say to Sarah that I would probably go over Christmas. But then part of me just feels like I'm being, you know, a lukewarm Christmas and Easter Christian. So this is even worse, as I understand it, than not going at all.
Yeah, maybe. Maybe you should just start putting some actual effort into your walk with God, Ben.
It's a limp at best.
Well, you know, the good thing about that is that, you know, the
footprints. If you footprint me, I swear to God.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, yes, I think we are putting Anglican down as the answer to that question.
Doesn't it also have a / for Episcopalian, though?
Yeah, yeah. It's Anglican / Church of England. I would accept Church of England if not Anglican for myself.
Which is so weird to me. That is so weird to me because, like, at least if you're Anglican, you could, like, there's a lot more expressions of that globally, right, than just the Church of England.
I'm Church of England in the way that I'm English. It's not really a choice that I've made. It's simply something I've been burdened with.
Fair.
But I think it's important to say that, like, as a podcast, we continue to try and be non-sectarian in our approaches to religion, both kind of, you know, in Christianity. We are open to many different expressions of Christianity, and we are also definitely
closed to many others.
Well, yeah. Well, yes, we've got issues with a bunch of forms of Christianity, if we're honest, but we don't like to be sectarian about it. It's theological objections, not simply like rivalry. Denominational rivalry has no place.
All right, yeah.
And I think there was a question as well about whether we wanted to meet another Christian podcast, or whether it could be someone from a different, you know, faith tradition or ex-Christian or whatever, which I think we are quite... We've had atheists before. We haven't actually had anyone from another religion, but we will work on that.
Have we not?
I don't think so.
Huh. Well, yeah, we'll have to put that right.
There's a question about faith. I think we've probably established the answer about what is your level of church involvement. The two of you are super keenos, and you're only going to get more keen.
Yeah, have submitted ourselves to the requirement, yes.
Then there's a question about what are your priorities in a church? Which I thought was quite an interesting question. I suppose my short answer would be, socialism.
you mean actual Christianity? Is that what you're...
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
But I thought it was an interesting question, actually, to briefly think about what our relationship to kind of church would be as Christians who are also leftists. I don't know if that question makes any sense.
I kind of get it in some way, in that I know what I don't like when I see a church, and I feel like it automatically says their politics. Like a church that has a really good website, right? Don't trust it.
And yet, it's really frustrating when you find a church that doesn't have a really good website, right?
Yeah, exactly. I want the right level of kind of slightly out of date, slightly a bit clunky, but you know, like, it's decent and stuff. You don't want, like, Windows 97 kind of website.
Well, you want it to be as aesthetically outdated,
yeah.
But with enough information to get a sense of things, right?
Yeah.
Could tell you're on the Catholic side of the church, right?
Yeah, exactly. But if you've got a really fancy website with, like, videos embedded that just play automatically and nice font and everything and whatever, and I'm like, I don't trust you.
But also, those websites are often the ones that don't have a lot of the important information on.
Exactly.
Right? Like, you can't actually find what they think about women and gay people to, you know, to shorthand some of that stuff. Like,
that's the thing though, because actually, like, you're both totally right, but equally, there's no reason why, like, churches that, you know, aren't homophobic or whatever can't have a good website. It'd be really good if we all just had really good websites where they just made it very clear and obvious, like, what they thought, including churches that were actually going to be, like, affirming and open and stuff.
So that's our church priority answer. Our church priority is a just shitty enough website.
Also free food.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. I mean, well, but again, I don't know. That could be definitely a...
Back off, Ben. This is a red line for me.
A red flag.
Yeah, well, it's a red line as well, so...
There should absolutely be free food at a church. Don't misunderstand me, but if they're advertising free food, there's a decent chance they're getting you in with free food to try and do an altar call.
Oh, yeah, 100%. Like I'm talking Agape meal styley stuff here, you know modern Agape meals, I suppose.
You really can tell which wing of the church you're from, can't you, when you say things like Agape meal, like...
Jesus weeps for Gaza. He sees the pain and suffering of the 1.9 million people who have been forced to leave their homes without access to nutritious food, clean water, decent shelter. He hears the cries of the 25,000 orphaned children. He is with all who mourn the 250 people killed every single day. Christians for Palestine UK is a group of Christians who are calling for an immediate ceasefire in Palestine. We don't pretend to have all the answers, but are united in our prayers, hope and action for equality, peace and justice for all the peoples of the Holy Land. Together, we are organising a Christian presence at the National Marches for Palestine and local Days of Action, where we've been joined by siblings from Sabil Kairos, Pax Christi, and a whole range of Christian churches. We urge you to join us to act in solidarity with the people of Palestine and call for a permanent ceasefire and just peace. The Very Reverend Canon Richard Sewell, Dean of St George's College in Jerusalem, says, "I warmly welcome the newly formed group, Christians for Palestine UK. Palestinians in Gaza and the West Bank need to see the solidarity of Christians in the UK, and they will be encouraged to see your commitment to stand up for them in their time of terrible suffering." To find details of local actions, or to join the Christian bloc at a national march, follow Christians for Palestine UK on Instagram and Facebook, or email christiansforpalestineuk@gmail.com. Join us as we call for a ceasefire now.
I want shepherd's pie and apple crumble and custard after church every Sunday, and then everyone can just leave at the end.
Yeah.
Sadly, you don't live anywhere near me, but tonight for dinner is cottage pie and like vanilla custard for pudding.
Oh, yes.
It's probably not too easy to pop in for dinner, unfortunately, but
Yeah, see, for me, that's like the best thing after church.
So free food. The thing about an agape meal, Adam, is that it tells me that you're like that's only low Anglicans refer to agape meals because you're just Anglican enough that you can't just call it communion because it doesn't
count. But they're different things. They are different bloody things, all right?
No, they're not.
Yes, they are.
No, they are
yes,
not.
Yes, they are. Communion takes place within an agape meal, and that's very important.
Yeah, and magic hands and all that shit. Yeah.
Wow, okay.
Do you believe me when I say I'm not an Anglican?
I believe you when you say you're not a Christian, Ben. So,
There's a section about telling us about yourself and personality. How would a good friend describe you? But I like this one. What makes you unique? What makes Bread and Rosaries unique?
Let's be honest, not a lot, really. I mean, we're British people doing something that Americans have already done. I mean, it's...
Yeah, but with accents. Ah. Different accents.
Better accents, some might say. Mm-hmm. Oh, come on. You can't laugh there, you assholes. You're going to hang me out to dry.
I don't want to start a fight with the Americans. There's so many of them.
They've got more guns.
And actually, these days, even the leftists have got guns, so we can't even talk shit about the Christian leftist Americans.
So that's what makes us unique, then. No, none of us own guns.
We don't have guns.
Yeah. So, okay, that's our unique thing. We're the one unarmed Christian leftist podcast.
And we're all freezing cold because none of us can afford the heating.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Okay, I'm going to input those details into Christian Connection, and I will let you know if we find another Christian podcast.
Do we do a little like beep boop beep boop sound as you put it in?
Beep beep boop boop beep boop beep beep. Beep.
What do we need? Is there not a section where we need to find out what the other podcast would be like? Like, do we have to say what our preferences are?
There's not a lot. I think because you're inherently narrowing it down by going to a Christian
dating website. Sort of narrow things down a bit too much, doesn't it? At the moment, you're not a reactionary on Christian Connection, you know. That's probably not fair, is it?
No, well, this is the interesting thing. So Christian Connection is quite a green belt, right? One thing I find really amusing is that it is, you can put your preferences for I'm a man looking for a man.
The right wing Christians kick off over this, didn't they? And they said, stop using Christian Connection. Yeah.
But also, you are only allowed to be a man or a woman.
Right. So they're not quite.
Which I suspect, being fair to them, is probably a lack of knowledge rather than a explicit attempt to exclude non-binary people.
They're trying, bless them.
Yeah. But we don't really have a lot else of that we can specify who we want. The other section that it asked was the political views, but there was a character limit on it, which I thought might present us with some issues. Because there's only so quickly you can summarise Karl Marx's views, right?
A lot of those websites will be, they're the only things they'll give. I think one of them was like very conservative, centrist, and then liberal, very liberal. It's like, oh, come on, guys. Like, you could do better than that.
I suppose, though, there's you know, how many leftists are on Christian Connection would be my question. But if you're listening to this and you're on Christian Connection, I would love to hear about your experiences on that.
They go to Greenbelt every year, Christian Connection. There are, like, singles nights at Greenbelt, sponsored by Christian Connection.
And speed dating.
Yeah. They do an LGBTQ one now as well.
Wow. That's good.
Greenbelt's gone to hell, really.
Yeah. Oh, well. I'll join them there. It's fine.
That's if hell looks like that, like, then I want to be there rather than heaven, right?
Yeah,
for sure.
Yeah. There's a bit of a, I don't know, that section's meant to be a bit of like a reintroducing the podcast a little bit for people who may be new or haven't listened to a lot or whatever. But now I'm a bit worried that people might genuinely think that we're not LGBTQ+ inclusive because I've just made some shitty joke about it.
You reactionary asshole.
Yeah. Well, I was thinking about this the other day. Like, I remember when I first started listening and like following and watching kind of Christian leftist content. Because of my experiences in conservative evangelicalism, I would always be just slightly on guard until I heard them explicitly affirm kind of like LGBTQ plus stuff, because you're just so used to people sounding like they might be all right, and then suddenly being like, the sin of sodomy, and you're like, oh, come on, you seem nice.
Maybe they mean the actual, sin of sodomy as, like, it's actually expressed in the Bible, right? Rather than, you know, this invention of it basically just being gay sex, you know? Just to clarify, the sin of sodomy has nothing to do with sex. It's all about hospitality.
It's a lack of hospitality, which in Adam's book basically means not giving food.
Amen. Right? Like, amen, brother.
Back to your food thing. Right, moving us forward. That was a new bit with lots of new stuff, but we're going to crack on with our classic segment, beloved, almost a cultural icon now. What else is on my mind, grapes?
What else is on my mind, grapes?
So, what's on my mind, grapes, is a bit of local politics. Which is not massively interesting to people, usually, I would suggest, but I think there's something revealing about it. I live in Cambridge, and for those of you who haven't seen, because apparently, although not according to the people who live here, Cambridge is not at the centre of the universe, but there is a proposal, I think it's been put forward by the local Liberal Democrats, to put a congestion charge in to Cambridge. So you're charging people to drive into the city centre. Something that already happens in London and possibly some other cities as well. Birmingham.
Wow.
Never heard of it.
Wow, Ben. You have just lost us like a million people.
Yeah.
A million potential listeners. Gone. Yeah.
Is Birmingham, do you think, is it the epicentre of British leftist Christianity?
No,
is that?
No, I don't think so. I think it's on its way. And we're working hard to make that happen.
Well, 2/3 of the podcast reside in Birmingham. I don't know if I'm just doxing you.
Great, yeah, thanks for that.
But I'm doxing myself for saying I live in Cambridge. So,
I mean, I've heard about the Cambridge thing mainly because that's where I grew up. So I saw it on the old local news. Sometimes I just have a little look-see. But it looks quite expensive, right?
So here's the thing, right, is that I don't necessarily want to go into the ups and downs of the idea. Cambridge is a fucking nightmare to drive in. So as part of Sarah's course, we actually have a parking space right slap bang in the city centre. We live kind of on the edge of the city. And I still don't drive in if I'm going into town. I will either walk if I'm going to take the dog, or I will get the bus, or I will... my bike's broken, but I would bike because driving is just so awful. It's a great city to bike in. It's pretty good to walk in. You've got decent public transport. So I can see why they want to deal with the congestion, because it's a bit of a nightmare. What is interesting about this is how it's been framed, and The Guardian put out an article. It might be technically The Observer, but I don't know what the difference is and I don't care, which is referring to it as town versus gown. And essentially, there's been a very successful campaign to brand this as a form of class warfare, basically making out that the people who are doing this are the rich university dons, and the common working man and woman, obviously, and whatever else, the common working person of Cambridge is going to be disproportionately hit by this. Of course, it's a really stupid way of characterising this for a few different reasons. Most of the Cambridge dons who live in the centre of the city don't drive, but actually the vast majority of them live outside the city and drive in. So the conflict is really between people who live outside the city and therefore drive into the city, and the people who live within the city who don't drive but have to deal with the congestion and the pollution that comes from all the people that drive. And it doesn't take a genius to work out that the class composition of the people in the suburbs of the city is quite posh, and the people who live inside the city limits is where the working class live. And I thought it was a fascinating example of how the ideas of class have been so totally skewed in this country. I mean, people will joke about being working class is having a regional accent. Doesn't matter how much you earn or anything else like that, that's what being working class is. And it does honestly feel like that sometimes. In this case, this is a plan that will increase public transport and reduce car transport. A lot of the poorer people in Cambridge, which is a really unequal city, don't have a car at all and rely exclusively on public transport, which will be made cheaper and more regular. And the middle class and upper classes who live outside the city are the ones who are going to have to pay for it. I don't know if it's necessarily the right thing. I don't want to get into the politics of congestion charges and all this sort of thing, mainly because I don't really know what the answer is myself. But the way the class narrative has been is actually taken by the right-wing opposition of this, but accepted by liberal institutions like The Guardian, so that what they present is a complete opposite of the reality of the class politics, I think probably is quite revealing about politics in the UK at the minute.
That was very intelligent.
I mean, I haven't got anything to add. You know what I mean? Like, yeah.
I feel like even if one of you could say something, otherwise it's just a segment of me ranting about class politics.
I'll say something, Ben. I think you're full of shit because everyone knows that there's no working class people in Cambridge, so...
Well, okay, so this is interesting. Cambridge is apparently the most uneven city in the country.
Which I
didn't know until I moved here. And what you get is this really posh central bit, and then all around the outside is terraced housing, lots and lots of working class communities.
Cambridge is one of those weird places. So I grew up in a town 20 minutes, half an hour drive from Cambridge, which is like quite normal for the sort of towns in the surrounding area. And like Cambridge was where my mum worked. My mum's a nurse, and we would go into Cambridge every weekend for like shopping, going to the cinema. So class wise, there's a lot of wealth, but there is also a lot of poverty. And because you're so reliant on cars, because the public transport was always so crap. So I'm kind of hopeful that if this does come in, then they'll actually massively revamp the public transport system. But I don't know if I have faith that that would happen.
As I say, I haven't seen the details of the plan or whatever, but it is, I think, super important to talk about. I think sometimes there's we need to disincentivize people driving, which is absolutely true. We need to massively reduce car transport in the country. But you can't do that without also massively increasing the availability and affordability of public transport. Public transport is all right in the city, but as soon as you get to any of the villages and towns outside, it's rubbish. To make the classic point, but it's worth saying again and again, the best by a long, long, long way public transport in the country is in the City of London, in London. And what distinguishes London public transport from every other city in England? It's publicly owned and massively subsidised.
And of course it is.
Because it makes sense. Mm. And of course it is in London, because like publicly owned transport systems work better and all the people who make the decisions live and work in London. So of course it is. It's all right for them. It's socialism for them, you know, but everyone else has to be privatised. Mm-hmm. Same old story.
Although TfL has been under a lot of, you know, the Tory government has tried to massively reduce the subsidy that they get, and there are real issues because of it. But I do take your point. And of course, you know, there is a point at which, you know, the City of London is in London, obviously. For our American listeners, the City of London is a specific place within London. It's confusing and stupid, but it's where the kind of financial hub is. And if the public transport in London did become crap, you would definitely hear an outcry from all the big financial accountancy, insurance people. And that they would not be allowed to be unhappy for too long, I'm sure. Adam, I believe you have something on your mind, Grapes.
Yes, I do. So there was a recent tweet from Zach W. Lambert, who said, "What's your funniest purity culture story? Mine's when my parents secretly installed Covenant Eyes on our computer. A week later, they confronted me about my, quote, porn addiction. I swore I wasn't, so they showed me my, quote, explicit searches. It had one entry. The Bare Naked Ladies," which for those who don't know, is a band. But then you've got loads of responses from people with their funniest purity culture stories. Some of my favourites: "My parents sobbed their guts out when I got a job at Disney. Then I met them for dinner once and ordered a Perrier, and my mum started sobbing uncontrollably because I ordered wine in front of them." Oh, this is a wonderful one. Found a purity ring for boys at a Lifeway once. I'm not sure what a Lifeway is. I assume it's
a Christian bookstore.
Okay,
there we go. So found a purity ring for boys at Lifeway once. The inscription said, "Greater is he who is in me." and I almost dropped it. I had to leave the store because I was laughing too hard and I wouldn't tell my mum what I was laughing at.
Oh, that is hilarious.
There's so many. I really recommend people go and have a look because it just, I just spent a long time laughing at these.
We'll link to it. There was some wonderful stuff in there.
I love the idea though that there was a whole software called Covenant Eyes.
Oh, there were multiple different softwares like Covenant Eyes designed to track your internet usage and send it to your accountability partner that they could tell whether you were masturbating to pornography or not.
Well, they could tell if you're watching pornography. They couldn't tell if
they're gonna masturbate.
No, but they would make that assumption.
Yeah.
Right?
I think all of us would. I think it's a reasonable assumption, to be honest.
Yeah. One of my favourite, right, so like obviously you've got loads of people tweeting their funniest purity culture stories. Have you ever heard of Mason Menenga? He does. Yeah, I can't remember which podcast it is, but yeah, he's all right. And he's just gone straight in. He's not even like my parents found out this or whatever. He's just like, one time I got to youth group before anyone else and went to the youth group computer and searched breasts on Wikipedia. That's it. There's no more context. That's it.
I love the best part of that is 100% is Wikipedia. It's not even Googling images searches. It's and now he's a I forgot the name for the type of doctor that deals with boobs. That's rubbish.
The boob doctor. Now he is the boob doctor.
That's definitely what they're called.
Yeah.
Should we move on to our main thing?
The boob doctor wasn't the main thing.
Sorry, you're right. Let's move on to the less important topics. We're going to talk about Christmas. We discussed at what point we do the recording, and the point was made to me by my esteemed Anglican co-hosts that as long as we were before Epiphany, we were still technically in Christmas. So I'm hoping to maybe get this out in time for actual Christmas. But if not, just know it's because we're really holy and we wanted to remind you that Christmas isn't over until Epiphany.
Does that mean you're holy, or does it just mean you want more drunken revelry?
What's the distinction you're drawing there? I'm confused. Adam, you just sent a message with one of my favourite phrases I've ever heard, which is, can I please talk about Danish Santa Claus army?
I did.
I don't know what that means, but I'm excited to find out.
Yeah, no, this is amazing. So basically, in 1974, a radical Danish theatre group, which I think is pronounced Solnen or something, basically spent 4 days getting dressed up as Santa Claus, like loads of them, and just causing havoc in Copenhagen. And it's wonderful. And like, you know, the idea was that they were challenging the sort of evil capitalist nature of Christmas and so on. But it sort of all culminated basically when they went to the, certainly what was then the largest department store in Copenhagen, and started handing out stuff from the shelves to people and saying, this year nobody pays. and it just caused absolute mayhem. But then, of course, the store manager comes running out saying that this is, you know, it's not as it is. And then the police turn up and start dragging these Santa Clauses off and, like, literally just beating them because, you know, cops. But then, of course, like, yeah, basically it's a riot by that, almost a riot by that point. And you've got kids just watching these Santa Clauses be beaten and just in floods of tears, you know, understandably, right? But the thing I love about it, I was reading an article from a publication called Mother Jones from 1977, so a few years after this happened. And on the fourth day, what they call Christmas Men, they all marched into this local kind of big trade union meeting place and delivered a big speech dressed as Santa Claus that had been written by one of them who was a respected law professor. And this law professor had been really instrumental in this whole action, this whole demonstration. And trying to prevent them getting arrested too early on. So, like, using very careful tactics. So this is an example of where a pacifist tactic was used very effectively. And so, you know, you could have 4 days of Santa Claus army rather than just getting nicked on the first day. So, yeah, they delivered this speech that he had written asking, you know, why there were not enough jobs or whatever. And then at one point you have this manager who comes out and starts announcing that entering private property is undemocratic. So you can imagine how that went down with them. But yeah, this group did something like that every year for a while afterwards. I don't think they're going anymore, but yeah, it's a fun story. You can read more about it in various places, but I learned about it from the Working Class History Facebook page, but they've got all sorts of stuff out, podcasts and that kind of thing.
Okay, so Adam, Luca, I have two questions for you.
Yeah.
Do either of you own Santa Claus outfits, and are you busy Christmas Eve?
No and no. Oh.
I needed a yes and a no, unfortunately. I know, Adam, you got an outfit?
I don't have one, but we could make one.
Okay. Adam, you, like me, are how do we put this gently, naturally suited to the role of Santa Claus.
Is it my big white beard?
Exactly.
Yeah, that's definitely what it is.
Big is definitely in the description somewhere. I can't believe that you, like, I have a Santa outfit because I just get asked to play Santa like a lot, and I can't quite believe that you don't just have one knocking about for the when you are asked to be Santa.
Well, the thing is, Ben, much like a young man, whatever that store's called, with a purity ring, I'm saving myself until I'm old enough to actually play Santa Claus, because this is actually a dream of mine, is to play Father Christmas. But I have to be, you know, I have to be old enough and grey enough for that role.
I'd like to pop your blow-up Santa. I'd like to bury it in the snow. Why don't you just put up a string of light? You don't have to put on a show.
So, we're going to talk about Christmas a bit, and we thought this would be a good opportunity to introduce another change to the show. I'm sorry if people are feeling a bit overwhelmed by the change. we didn't add this to our Christian Connection profile, but I think we are an officially neurodiverse podcast. So please understand that if you're struggling with change, then we are too. But we are adding a new segment, which is going to be called Saint of the Week for now, until we think of a better name. Having said that, so the reason we don't like it is that we're not a weekly podcast, we're a fortnightly podcast, but Saint of the Fortnight doesn't really work. But also, I think we're just having a loose definition of week, but also a loose definition of saint, to mean literal saint in the Catholic understanding, saint as in anyone who's ever been a Christian, or perhaps at its most broad, someone we want to talk about because we thought they were interesting. But Person of the Fortnight is less exciting than Saint of the Week.
At least we're kicking it off with someone who is actually a saint, though.
True.
Like, undeniably.
Yeah, definitely a saint.
Lou, would you like to talk to us about our official Saint of the Week?
Saint of the Week.
Yeah, Adam was meant to write a theme, so we've got an improvised one.
Hey, you don't know whether I have. I might have written a jingle already.
No, that's the jingle. Lucas just done it. Cool. Sorted.
Yeah.
So our saint of the week is Saint Nicholas, who is he was born in 270 AD and died in 343 AD, and he is definitely a saint. He's called Nicholas the Wonder Worker, which I like. He's like the patron saint of a lot of things.
Can I just say, if I was the patron saint of wonder, that would just be my entire life ambition fulfilled. Just putting it out there. Yeah.
Exactly. That's great, yeah. Isn't it? So he's the patron saint of sailors, merchants, archers, repentant thieves, children, brewers, pawnbrokers, unmarried people and students.
That's such a long list.
I know.
They do, though. There's so many of them. But like, what I want to know, though, is who's the patron saint of unrepentant thieves?
Well, we need to find that out, really. Maybe if people are listening and know who the unrepentant thief patron saint is, they should send it in. Also, the falsely accused and broadcasters, which I quite like, and coopers, which Cooper is the person who makes like a barrel, which would make sense if he's also the patron saint of brewers. And we'll come on to maybe perhaps why that is in a minute.
I like that. That's foreshadowing. That's good. That's great.
It is.
It's great
foreshadowing
podcasting.
About why
we've taken it up to a whole new level since you've joined us.
Yeah. I mean, I was just impressed. It sounds like you've actually done some research, which is very out of character for the podcast. But it's
I was just deeply pleased when you said Lou's name rather than mine for doing this segment, because I thought I was meant to be doing it, and I'd done bugger all. So.
So he did a lot of stuff. I mean, probably the one that maybe people are familiar with is that, like, the one of the most famous ones is that he's said to have rescued three girls or like daughters who had been forced into prostitution or marriage or something like that. And each night for three nights, he drops gold coins into their shoes, which are by their beds or by their windowsill.
I heard stockings hanging up over the fireplace.
Oh, stockings. Okay, well, yeah. There's something that St. Nicholas puts gold coins in them, and then they don't have to be bought into prostitution or something like that.
So the shoe thing, I think it might be shoes, and here's why. So bit of Ben's personal history, but my parents actually met in Brussels in Belgium. They lived there as
you bougie fuck.
Well, yeah. When you find out why, it's because both my grandfathers were sent there for work reasons.
of course.
They met there, and one of the traditions they kind of took back from when they moved back to the UK was St. Nicholas Day, which I think,
6th of December.
6th of December, and you leave a shoe out, and St. Nicholas put something in your shoe, which was great, and my parents did it when we were little kids. However, they grew to regret it, because the tradition is your shoe gets bigger as you get older, and you get a bigger present. Oh. But they had unwittingly spawned a freak, and as my shoes continued to grow larger and larger, they despaired at having to fill what eventually turned out to be size 14 shoes with presents every year.
What's the best present you got in one of your shoes?
It would often be I want to say Leberkusen, but that's not right, isn't it? What do you know?
Leberkusen.
Leberkusen. Yeah,
I assume that's how you say it.
I often got Leberkusen.
Yeah, that is good.
Mm. Yeah, and delicious stuff. And one of those foods like mince pies that are delicious mainly because they're only like available for a month in the year.
I mean, you can make them.
I think I'd be sick of them if I had them.
No,
all...
no. I mean, I absolutely love them. I would eat them all year round. So, and I don't think I'd get sick of them. They shouldn't be out for a month. They should be out for longer than that.
Oh, these days, Adam, Christmas is getting longer and longer, isn't it? Shops get earlier and earlier.
Look, it's just gingerbread, all right? You can have gingerbread at any bloody time of the year. Ginger doesn't even grow natively here.
Sorry, Lou, I interrupted you to talk about my feet, which might bring us a new audience, but isn't what we're here to talk about. So,
not much more interesting about that particular story, although it's claimed that when their father found out that it was St. Nicholas, St. Nicholas insisted that he should not tell anybody it was him. So he didn't want to be recognised for doing this charitable thing. Another well-known, I guess, but contested story is that St. Nick was at the First Council of Nicaea, but he turned up, but he was never mentioned, or maybe he was mentioned and then he couldn't join in anymore because he slapped the heretic Arius.
I heard he punched him.
Yeah, oh, okay. I heard punched was the
punched.
Story.
But which then, is more fun.
It sounds like the story might be apocryphal anyway, so I don't think it matters. So I'm going with punched.
Yeah, agreed.
Punched him in the face. Yeah. Mainly because Arius, I think, believed that, I'm hoping I'll get this right, Adam might be able to help me, God the Son did not exist before God the Father, or there was a time when God the Son did not exist.
Yeah.
So at one point there was just God the Father. And then, like, he spawned the Trinity.
And obviously this stuff is super, super settled now in kind of mainstream Christian theology. But it's fascinating to think that, whether or not that story is true, the fact that it was believable enough that someone would have got pissed off enough with that heresy to punch someone tells you quite how seriously that stuff was being taken at the time.
Yeah, definitely.
Wait, what, are we not taking it seriously anymore? Or?
I'm not. I barely go to church. We've been over this.
You're getting punched, Ben. You're getting punched for Christmas.
I deserve it, but not for any of the Christian stuff.
Christmas punch.
It's Christmas punch. But not the good kind.
Tina here just found out that her best friend Jocelyn told Jimmy Jr. that Tina is whack and acting.
Tina, Jocelyn told me you are whack. Jocelyn, you skank, I hate you.
Whatever, it's true. You are whack.
And freeze! Well, that resolved nothing. Let's rewind, shall we? Let's work out our abs. Hey, access your feelings!
When you gossiped about me to Jimmy Jr., it hurt my feelings.
Be apologetic.
Sorry.
S, slap it! Well done. Do it just like that at the dinner. Oh, enjoy your lunch, everyone!
If you ever gossip about me to Jimmy Jr. outside of a conflict resolution skit, I'll punch you in the face.
It was just a skit, Tina.
I will punch you again and again and again.
My absolute favorite story was how basically there was a terrible, terrible famine and lots of people were dying and that kind of thing. And a butcher who was like an evil butcher, he stole three children or lured three children into his house. And then he killed these three children and he put them in a barrel and he was going to try and sell them as ham, like pickled the children to make into ham. But then Nicholas saw through the butcher's lies, like he knew this, and so he resurrected the pickled children.
Do you think they spent the rest pickled. Of their lives just smelling like pickles?
Yeah, that's what
I would say. Adam and I are the same wavelength.
But that's maybe where the barrel thing comes in.
Can I ask, the obvious question here is the story of Sweeney Todd related to this at all?
I mean, maybe.
I don't know.
Do
they get pickled in Sweeney Todd? Or?
No, they get made into pies, don't they?
Yeah, yeah.
But it's not children that... get made into pies. I think it's grown-ups as well, isn't it?
Yeah, but then there's a second version of the story of the pickled children where it was like students going to an inn and the innkeeper pickled the students like passing through and St. Nicholas happened to be staying there like the next day or something and God revealed it to him in a dream.
I'll be honest with you, as a Cambridge resident, pickling students is increasingly feeling like less of an extreme measure.
Well, most students pickle themselves on a Friday night, don't they? So,
Adam and I were sort of enjoying talking about this because I found a picture of St. Nicholas resurrecting three children. And St. Nicholas looks quite young and he's like wearing all his regalia and his bishop stuff. And then there's like three tiny henchmen. Who have been like coming out of a like a barrel, and obviously they're supposed to be children. But my favourite part of it, apart from the fact they're all like really muscly pickled children, is the fact that one of them has got a receding hairline and a bald patch on top of his head.
Which is really common when you see depictions of Jesus, actually, because the idea was like children were imperfect forms of humans. And so often you'll see Jesus like just... immediately after Mary's given birth to him, come out as a tiny, muscly, bald man, because that's clearly the perfect form of humanity, as a middle-aged man with a receding hairline.
That's so weird. Like the idea that Jesus had a receding hairline when he was born.
Good news for you, Adam, then.
Well, okay, I do not have a receding hairline. I might be approaching middle age.
I know you're not even denying the middle age bit.
No. It's the hair that matters. I'm going to get old, but the hair bloody stays, all right?
One of the many reasons that people can't tell the difference between you and I is that we both basically look like shit, but with excellent hairlines.
Yeah, do you know what's frustrating though? It's like I do actually have quite a high hairline, so people do sometimes think I'm receding, and I've had that since I was a child.
Maybe you're the perfect man then, Adam.
I am. How could you not tell?
So that's another point for Adam being the Jesus of the podcast, then, is it?
Yeah, because he's got the perfect hairline. So obviously that's how we see Jesus. Anyway, so that's all my facts about St. Nick. One of the youngest bishops or something, because he was 30 when he became a bishop.
And he wasn't even a priest before he became bishop.
No way.
Which is surprisingly common back then.
Oh, really?
He was only a
Wow, a monk. Okay.
The idea is that the former bishop had died, and then the bishop whose job it was to find another bishop, God revealed who the bishop should be to him in a dream, and it would be the first person who walked into the church that morning whose name was Nicholas, and it was Nicholas. Oh. But he was only a monk at the time.
Right.
And another interesting thing if you would like to know, which I think really is how we can know that St. Nicholas was 100% a communist, is that he was born into wealth. His parents died. He inherited everything, but he rejected it all and joined a monastery and vowed to give all his wealth away, which is different to philanthrocapitalism because he did it without wanting to be known for it.
Yeah, a lot of his the legends and stuff around him is all him doing miracles and stuff and then not letting anyone know about it or telling people off if they go and say, oh, he gave me this or he gave me that.
So the I think the pickled children and the what was the other one? The pickled children. There's two that like are almost certainly apocryphal. And one of them's a pickled children one. But then the others probably have like...
Oh, ye of little faith, Adam.
I think the pickled children is the most legit out of them all.
Okay, go on.
No, I'm just... That's, I just want to believe in it.
It's just a statement.
Hey, it works for other Christians. Like, it can work for us,
yeah,
right?
Exactly.
I agree. I think two main reasons. One is that I can absolutely understand the desire to pickle children. They're very annoying.
Wow.
And two,
wow.
Don't ask what I do for a living. two, were I to have the power to resurrect children, I presumably would also have the power to make them super hench, and I would absolutely use that. So it does, it's all coming together, right?
Yeah.
And to recede their hairlines, or...
Yes, yeah, that would just be very funny to me.
I'm just slightly concerned, Ben, because it makes it sound like what you do for a living is to pickle children.
I don't think you get paid for that. I think that's more of a love of the game type deal.
Well, you do when you sell it.
Well, yeah, true. We have a modern-day saint to talk about, I think.
Wow, okay.
That's a bold statement, isn't it? Because we're going to talk about Mick Lynch. Mick Lynch is the head of the Rail, Maritime and Transport Workers Union, known as the RMT. And as you're probably all aware, they have been on strike. Other people who have been on strike include nurses, ambulance workers, and a bunch of other really important people who shouldn't be doing it because they're too important to be allowed to strike, but not quite important enough to be paid properly. It was interesting, particularly because you might have seen the Metro ran a headline where it just said, "It's Mick Grinch," which honestly feels like a pun they wrote in search of a reason to use it rather than the other way around. But it has been interesting the way that Christmas has been used as an anti-union kind of rhetoric. Someone did point out that Mick Lynch is a proper Anglican in that he's happy to strike up to Christmas Eve because we all know Christmas doesn't start properly until Christmas Eve.
Yep.
Yeah, thanks. You need to confirm that, Lou, because that's just something I read online, but I have no idea if it's accurate. But yeah, it's been really interesting. He and a bunch of other kind of union leaders have been obviously the focus of right-wing attacks from both the media and from kind of general right-wing politicians, figures, activists, whatever.
The right-wing media monstering a union leader. Yeah. Surely not.
But unfortunately, some of our allegedly more liberal or centrist or balanced media outlets have, and then you can be fake surprised again at this, Adam, been taking the lead of the right-wing media on these issues. There was this really... Yeah, they good fake shock, Adam.
Thank you.
There was this really shit BBC article, which was basically a bunch of people being interviewed about how the rail strikes would disrupt their plans over Christmas, which was ridiculous because basically all of them, it boiled down to, yeah, I'm going to have to travel on a different day, which I get was quite frustrating, but maybe isn't the end of the world. But it was obviously an attempt, well, it felt like pretty clear propaganda to me. And so what we wanted to talk a little bit about is, as Christians, who I presume value Christmas to a fairly high degree, how can we understand Christmas in a way that is maybe supportive of our unions rather than shitting on them?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think at a fairly basic level, if we just take it back to what the gospel writers were trying to do, there's this idea of Jesus coming from the most humble beginnings and how that is seen as him coming for the poor, you know, for people who are screwed over, frankly, by the world as it is. And so at a very basic level, we have to support those who are going on strike so they can actually afford to eat. I mean, you know, we've got a situation now where the majority of hospitals, for example, have food banks in them because NHS staff can't afford to feed their families with the wages that they're getting. And so we hear that, you know, we hear fairly often, I think, and when we watch the news and stuff, oh, 19% pay rise for nurses. How can they ask for that much? Well, you know, apart from anything, in real terms, their pay has been cut for, you know, a decade or more now, to the point where it's nowhere near what it would have been if it had kept up with inflation. So if we're going to be honest with what our faith tradition tells us, then we have to side with those who are just trying to get a fair wage.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think there's something interesting about there is a certain kind of faux radical critique of the commercialization of Christmas,
yeah,
or, oh, it's all about presents and buying stuff now. It falls into that classic thing of people describing themselves as anti-consumerist, which is a way of kind of being like, oh yeah, I oppose kind of too much spending or getting overexcited over stuff, without actually being anti-capitalist, without really dealing with the problems of capitalism properly. And I think there's two problems with that. One is obviously you're failing to deal with the problems posed by capitalism, which is a fairly major set of problems in our opinion. I think I'm happy to speak for the three of us on that one.
Yeah, we'll let you have that one.
Yeah. Also, I think there is a kind of inherent almost shaming of people for wanting nice stuff.
Yeah.
You know, it's the same sort of thing you get when you get that description of union barons or whatever.
Yeah.
You know, when people talk about, oh, things are too consumerist now, they don't mean Jeff Bezos has got too much fucking money. They mean you've bought a little bit too much tat. And yes, we all need to be buying less tat, don't get me wrong, and I am not a particularly Christmassy person, so less Christmas decorations is, you know, I'm kind of on board with that. But I think there's something important about actually people are making decisions to get by under capitalism. Yes, we need a whole reconfiguring of the mode of production and mode of consumption that is ecologically sustainable and is also much more equitable, moving beyond capitalism. I think we all accept that that's what's necessary. But if all you're doing is saying, oh, it's bad for you to spend money on stuff, or buying too much stuff, all you're really doing is saying, working people, people that don't have a lot but are doing what they can to make a slightly nice life for themselves, you got to stop doing that. You should really live in vows of poverty. And I don't know, it just feels like this is just another example of that, where the whole, oh, Christmas has become too commercialized. It's a fair point. There was an annoying commercialization of Christmas, but really all it comes down to is telling people off for trying to have a nice time in a bit of a shit time. And then the strange thing is, of course, you've got that critique, and then people are going, oh, where's your Christmas spirit? It's not all just about money, to these union striking, saying, oh, all you want is more money and more stuff or whatever. It's not very Christmassy. Why are you ruining Christmas for people? But at the same time, how are they ruining Christmas? Well, a lot of it is about, oh, I can't get the training to do my Christmas shopping. Oh, I can't go and spend this money. Yes, like maybe there are some like people who wanted to come home for a bit longer to see family or whatever, but a lot of it does seem to boil down to, this is a personal inconvenience to me. And if you're going to criticize commercialization, then surely doing it from the basis of, because it hurts me as an individual, is kind of defeating the point.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, this whole thing is all so individualistic. I mean, there's nothing, you know, going back to your kind of Christmas decorations example, there's nothing wrong with decorating things. There's nothing wrong with gift giving. There's nothing wrong with having a celebration and spending time with family. But when everything becomes so much about buying the latest this, the latest that, you know, that intrinsically individualistic nature of that has a way of completely clouding our judgment about everything else. People aren't striking because they're greedy. People are striking for two main reasons. One, because their pay is not fair. And we need pay, incredibly, to have a roof over our heads, to have food, to have heating, and yes, to have a few luxuries as well, what you might call luxuries, you know, but a few sort of items that maybe you don't need, but the kinds of items that make life a little bit nicer. There's nothing wrong mm-hmm. with that, right? That's okay. But people somehow are only able to see things, as you say, through their own eyes, through their own experience of the world, so much of which has been filtered through an ideological lens that they've been given without necessarily noticing.
I really hate the misinformation and the judgment that is coming from people. And even that sort of thing of like, oh, well, I've never been on a strike, or I would never strike, or whatever. And it's like, well, if you're not part of a union and you don't support the unions or whatever else, and you don't even consider that to be an option, like when it's not part of the kind of cultural language or capacity, then I guess there is also misunderstanding about what striking does mean.
And I think when people are saying like, oh, I've never been on strike, like at best you're a coward, at worst you're a scab, right?
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
I don't know I'd go that far, right?
That's a bit of a joke.
Yeah, I mean, but those people exist, obviously. But like the reason people don't go on strike is because the unions were crushed and have been, had union rights whittled away for the best part of 40 years now, right? So it doesn't even feel like an option, because all the laws around unionization and striking are so restrictive, right? And then you know, add that to the fact that, you know, it's not really that it's individual people that are coming up with this, you know, these nonsense ideas. It's a right-wing media, right? The media landscape in our country, even amongst the supposedly, you know, left-wing kind of publications in the mainstream, is really right-wing, right? And so all these ideas, all this bullshit that we hear about, you know, Mick Grinch and all the rest of it, comes straight out of media that is by and large controlled by billionaires, right? And like, of course they're going to call him Mick Grinch. You know, of course they're going to frame this in a way as to say that, you know, striking nurses or train drivers or, you know, at this point, you know, half of society are all greedy bastards and you should hate them, right? And people take that on. You know, people that it works, right? It works.
And yet, I don't disagree that it works, but it's not working as effectively. You look at the statistics, and by a narrow margin, but a majority of people are supportive of the strikes currently. And that skews, obviously, much more supportive on both younger people and people with less money.
Yeah, of course it does.
Of course.
Because they're the ones getting screwed.
Yeah, if you're not getting screwed and you're paying for like your private hospital and you're not worrying about heating or anything else, then you're not going to get your head around it, are you?
Exactly. Exactly. You know, I've had, because, you know, I'm on the old TikTok, you know, I've been doing, you know, videos about this kind of thing recently. And I've had, you know, people in my comment section, and one person in particular, actually, who, you know, every so often you'll get someone who comes along and they just comment on everything you do and they're super angry and they decide to follow you. And it's like, why do you, you know, it's like the classic.
And that's how we
met. Exactly. It's like the classic Mean Girls thing, isn't it? Why are you so obsessed with me? But, you know, I've got people in my comments talking about how dare these, in particular, nurses go on strike when they get more money than such and such people.
It was nurses, right? Originally, it was, oh, these train drivers are striking, but they don't make as much as nurses. You don't see the nurses striking.
Yeah, you can't win.
And then the nurses started striking. And now the nurses, oh, they see these people. You know,
but the answer to...
It's all just bollocks.
The answer to, you know, striking workers from whatever thing is not to say, yeah, but they get more than these people, don't they? You know, what about the rest of us who don't get as much? The answer to that is to go on bloody strike.
Exactly.
Right? Like, we want decent pay, not just for nurses, not just for train drivers, but for you as well.
Yeah. Well, unless you're like a bank or something.
Yeah, all right. You know, no, I mean, even bankers
take the
job away from them and give them a council house,
we'll
right?
We'll redistribute to something, a more useful job. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. I think my main thing is just to encourage people to join their union.
A good union.
And to
a good radical union.
A good union And as a first step, I think to be honest about being in a union, like talk to your mates about being in a union and what that means, like just as like a gentle hint, or, you know, when you're at the pub or whatever, and, you know, you say, you're just chatting away and you think, oh, you just mention, I don't know, like being part of a union and how important that is, and that kind of thing. Because I think part of the problem, certainly with my generation, is that the unions had been already so decimated by the time we were sort of born. It's not part of our common language or identity. So I guess I'm also seeing it from that angle, that actually part of it is getting people to understand the importance of becoming part of a union that works for them and what their career is, really.
I think it's worth saying on that as well, that as we've seen over the last 40 years and as we will continue to see as union laws get more and more restrictive, you know, that does drive people away from unions. But it's really important to remember that some of the biggest victories that unions have had in their history have been during times when they are illegal or sort of de facto illegal or suppressed. Mm-hmm. Right. You know, when people joined them en masse because they had no choice. And so I think, you know, if your answer to you should join a union is, but they don't really do anything or they can't accomplish anything, they absolutely can if they're radical enough, if they're willing to actually put some real stuff on the line and go out and demand better. And the other objection I often hear to unions is, I don't think I'm going to need one. My job's all right. And it's like, it's not just about you, you know, because like that may be true. It may be true. You may have a surprise and it's not true, in which case you will be very thankful that you have joined a union. But it's not just about you. We need to realize that we should not be seeing life in general, but especially union membership, as an individualistic kind of thing. You know, it's not about you as an individual are being screwed over. It is that, but it's also about all of us collectively. There's a, you know, the point of a union is collective bargaining, not I've had an issue at work as an individual, can you come and represent me? We need to stand together in our unions. Not just as individuals.
Yeah, and I think I want to drag us back to about Christmas a little bit to finish it off. But it's not just about you is I think a really good summary of what's going on here. And I've been thinking a little bit about that, you know, very nebulous concept of the meaning of Christmas. And, you know, I guess there's that kind of Christian sense of it as being that celebration of the birth of Jesus, and thinking about it as this kind of gift of love and care to the whole world and all of humanity and, you know, all that kind of stuff. But, you know, even for people who maybe don't have a Christian relation to it, it's still quite an important festival. There is a tendency, I think, that is being moved away from to talk about it in terms of family. And I think both as leftists who have at least some interest in changing what family might mean, and also for me personally, as someone who works with kids in care, whose relationship with family is obviously quite complicated, to put it mildly, I'm very keen to see this move away from family as the main focus. But something about communities, I think, in a more broad sense, and about, you know, and for a lot of us, one of our main communities will be family, but it's not the only one. Something about Christmas being a time of gathering and celebrating together as community, and if we're taking Jesus as this kind of universal gift of love, then actually as Christians our community is everyone, right? And that includes nurses, train drivers, postmen and women. Our community that we are celebrating with is everyone. And so I think if we're trying to understand Christmas and what it might represent and mean, the critique of Christmas as a too commercial is one that doesn't really work for me. But there is a redefining or a rethinking of Christmas, I think, available to us that is deeply Christian, that also includes solidarity with strikers and solidarity with, you know, asylum seekers and with oppressed communities of all different shapes, sizes, etc. And I guess I wanted to kind of ask, if either of you had kind of thoughts about what your conception of Christmas might be, kind of as both Christians and leftists, maybe paying particular attention to solidarity with strikers.
Radical hospitality, always.
Yeah.
I like that. Unpack it.
I think there is something really important about feeding people, about gathering people together with no agenda, just resting. I think there's always something really important about letting people like sleep and feel restored and held. Those kind of needs that we sort of forget about, and actually a time of just settling down and being with. And we can all take on those different caring roles, and sometimes we need to be cared for, and sometimes we do the caring, but it's communal and it's based, rooted in love and sharing. And I think having that, when you don't have to have a birth family that functions really well together to get that, but it's also about finding those places where that can be offered and holding out an olive branch to those who might need that, and being aware, like, you've got to look out for those people and invite them in as well.
And I suppose there's something I think particularly important about you know, queer communities have always changed up those relations of care in a non-family setting, because sadly many of them had been rejected by family or found family difficult for
exactly.
reasons. And I think that's something really instructive in kind of queer models of mutual care in non-family settings.
Yeah, I think that that's kind of been really modelled well by the queer community, but also it is wider than that. And especially at a time when we are all struggling in various ways, whether that is to do with heating or food or whatever, remembering actually the reasons for Christmas aren't all the gifts and every, you know, all of that, but the gift is actually just being with people and resting and making a cup of tea for someone.
Yeah.
That's what I kind of really want to hold on to, that actually one of the greatest evils of our 11, 12 years of austerity and the Tory government has been this rapid sense of individualization and only being out for yourself and only caring about yourself, because they've pushed so many people to such an extent that they feel like that is the only option. And for me, that's one of the greatest evils, because what it's done is that we see other people suffering and we no longer have the capacity to care, or they've made us believe we no longer have the capacity to care because we're all hurting. And that's not very articulate of me, but I think there is something so insidious and so awful about that, that actually people are now so helpless to do anything that helping your neighbour almost just seems too much.
I think there's something really important as well. You use that phrase, being with people.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think some people might listen to this and think, well, that's all well and good, but, you know, what's the real Christian Christmas story? And actually, God being with people, right?
Yeah.
Like, I think it's so important to, you know, I think we, you know, kind of hark on about this a little bit, but trying to make the Christianity of what we're saying really explicit, not out of any sense of Christian supremacy, but out of a wanting to reclaim that Christianness and that branch of Christianity as central, because what is more Christmas from a Christian perspective than being with people? Because that's what the incarnation is. The celebration of Christmas is the celebration of a God who chooses to be with people. So I think it's really important to say, like, yes, for I'm sure there's plenty of non-Christians could absolutely agree with what you said there, Lou. And it's not something that Christianity has a monopoly on, but it is deeply Christian to talk about being with people.
And it's also worth saying on top of that as well, that the incarnation didn't start and end with Christmas.
No.
I think we need to see this, you know, radical hospitality that you're talking about as something that, yes, Christmas perhaps is a way of reinvigorating what that looks like, but actually it has to be something that's present throughout the year. Sometimes, you know, you will see that there are churches and community organizations that are really, really good at offering support to people, whether it be, you know, a night shelter or a meal on Christmas Day or whatever it is, at this time of year or at particular times of year. But then there also goes along with that this idea that, you know, if you offer that too much, if you're not just having a winter night shelter, but an all year round shelter, that you are in some way creating dependence, right? And maybe that's true, right? Maybe that is true. But the reason that that may be true isn't that the people who end up dependent on something are therefore bad and immoral people who don't deserve it. It's because we live in a society that has taken away our support networks, has gradually eroded any mechanisms that exist within society to help people who don't function in the ways that a capitalist society requires in order to thrive. You know, there are people who live their most of their lives homeless, not because it's not possible to get a job or not possible to, you know, do all of the things that would make you not homeless anymore, but because they just don't work in that way. Maybe their brains don't work in that way. Maybe their body doesn't work in that way. And sometimes, you know, it'll be often, in fact, it will be, you know, trans people, you know, who have lost access to their community just by being who they are.
And that
stuff matters all year round. So the fact that, you know, you might be quote unquote, you know, creating dependence means very little to me personally. If there is a need there, we should be meeting it.
And we all have dependents.
Yeah,
we are exactly. all dependent yeah. on other people. And I think that, again, that's that sense of what the Tories have done over so many years has made it seem that depending on others, because we are human and relational, and that's we need other people in order to survive, is a bad thing. We must always go it alone. And it just feeds into the evil narrative that does and continues to do so much harm.
Yeah.
Because we need that. We need to be dependent on having a warm bed and hot food and care and kindness and laughter and all of those things.
Yeah.
What's so wrong about that, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
And to bring it back to Christmas, you know, Jesus is a baby. What are those more dependent form of human being than a baby? You know, he literally depended on his parents to provide him with everything he needed to survive. You know, and if that's good enough for the God of the universe, that's good enough for us.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think you're absolutely right. It's so important that this myth of independence, which is no one's independent. We live in communities, we are in communities, like that's who we are. We are social animals, but also just to function in everyday life. I do not grow and produce and cook all my own food, right? That is not how humans exist. When I make my way to work, I rely on the people who've made my car and the road builders and, you know, everything else. And yeah, people make my clothes. You know, we are dependent creatures. That is the reality. And this myth that we have to find ways of not depending on each other, or perhaps more specifically, that there are some form of dependence that is unacceptable, and some forms that are fine. And that basically boils down to, are you depending on people who you can push out of sight, or are you depending on people in a much more public setting like a homeless shelter? Yeah, I think that's just nonsense. And as I say, to bring it back to that Christmas thing, you know, God chose dependence. And I think that is such a, you know, like a lot of liberal hand-wavy Christians, I am much keener on the incarnation than on the crucifixion. And I just think that's such a theologically rich thing to think about, that has, you know, not just in the terms of what does it mean for sacredness to inhabit humanity, but also just in terms of what does it mean for God to be a dependent human baby. There's so much there that we can pull out as important resources for good political work, I guess.
Well, it's important, isn't it, to remember that it's not just the case, as we're often told and as our theologies often emphasize, that humans killed Jesus. Humans also nurtured Jesus. Humans also loved Jesus and taught Jesus, and you know, and that is just as important, if not more important.
So, in conclusion, I don't know if lies make the baby Jesus cry, but scabbing certainly does.
Amen.
support your workers, get involved in a union, and have a very Merry Christmas. Amen. Is that a good conclusion?
Agreed.
That's a very good conclusion.
Thank you very much for joining us. We are back. We're going to be back on a slightly normal schedule in the new year. This is a bit of a bonusy Christmassy one, and then we're all going to be eating lots of food and not doing very much over the next couple of weeks, but we'll be back in the new year with our usual fortnightly episodes. You can find us on all the usual podcast feed places. You can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/breadandrosaries. You can find us Twitter at @bread_rosaries. And you can email us breadandrosaries@gmail.com. Please do get in contact with us. I think we put out more than one shout out to people to get in contact with us in this episode. But any sort of feedback, anything you want to say, anything you'd like to hear us talk about, questions, comments, thoughts, etc. We love hearing from people, and we are going to get better at replying to you. So if you're one of the two people who I haven't replied to yet and you're listening to this, I'm sorry, I'll get on it. Adam, where in the world can people find you?
You can find me on most platforms at @commiexian.
Wonderful. Luca, you don't want people to find you, do you?
No, but I live very close to Adam. So if you go to Adam's flat, you might find me.
Thank you very much for listening, everyone. Thank you, Luke. I called you Luke there. That's not your
Luke,
fake
that's
name.
That's all right. It's, it's a good one. It's a good another saint, isn't it?
True, yeah. Thank you, Luca. Thank you, Adam. And we will see you all next time. Bye.
See you later.
Bye.
Yeah. Sorry. Give me one moment.
Oh.
For fuck's sake, Ben.
Honestly.
Tosser.
Just getting into the flow there.
Exactly, exactly. And he has to go and take a call. Probably from work as well,
yeah,
with his real
probably.
Job. What an arsehole. Trying to make us all look bad. I always feel like this is a good place to just do a little, like, you should sign up to our Patreon and give us lots of money because we can't pay for heating. And yet we put on a podcast.
Yeah. Pay for our heating now.
We will continue pouring warm vomit into your ear holes. Warm Christian vomit.
Warm Christian vomit. It's better than cold Christian vomit.
Oh, good grief. Can you imagine if every time you threw up, it was cold?
Oh, gosh. Oh, that is awful. That makes it so much more worse.
It really does.
Yeah.
It's bad enough as it
oh,
is.
Oh, no. I don't want that. Or having a cold wee.
Oh.
That's not nice either.
I really hope Ben's the one that edits this.
Yeah, I hope so, because I think I'd want to keep cold vomit and cold wee in there.
You could just start the episode with that.
Yeah,
right?
I think
cold vomit and cold that wee.
So I took my headphones off because I got a work. I'm on call, but I could just about hear. But so I heard my name and the words cold vomit. That's all I picked
saying,
up.
We're just saying, Ben, how Bread and Rosaries podcast is sponsored by cold vomit and cold wee.
So I have a question on that. When you say cold wee, are we talking wee that has been chilled, or wee from a person who is so cold that
the
wee that's going
the person
cold?
Is warm and yet somehow
the wee is
cold.